The entire forest stops and heeds when the sonorous horn is sounded. Deer lie at the spring and listen. Even the frogs slip out of the water, and sows lie nearby in sweet slumber while their piglets suckle in 3/8 time. But the same all-powerful horn, ringing out in gentle tones from forest hills, compels the deer lying by the mossy spring to raise its antlers and soak up the sound. This over-the-top, nostalgic description of the sounds of the aristocratic hunt was given in 1784 by the German poet and composer Christian Schubart. Sonorous horn calls, triplet-y meters, and generally antler-raising sounds can be heard in abundance in the third Music at Menlo concert of this season, The Thrill of the Hunt, given by the Calidore Quartet on Saturday, July 23rd. Hi, I'm Nikki Sweat. I'm your host for Audio Notes this season, and on this session, I'll be thinking about how instrumental music becomes about something. A composer or a listener might have an association, image, or issue in mind when writing or hearing a particular piece. And different composers and listeners sometimes share such associations. So how do particular musical gestures take on consistent and quite culturally specific meanings, like the hunt? In this case, the story starts with a very literal association. Riders on a hunt would signal to one another using simple horns. Many of the common calls involved the repetition of a single note, sometimes with little turn figures. As the mechanism of the instrument of the horn developed, it became able to play a range of notes, but because production of a sound on the instrument relied on help from the overtone series, it was generally easier to play leaping arpeggiated gestures than scales. And sometimes two horns would play together, in alternating sequences of cheerful thirds and bright open fifths. A form of counterpoint that was particularly acceptable and comfortable for that instrument. These were characteristic horn, and thus hunt, gestures. Duets in so-called horn fifths, chirping neighbor tones on repeated pitches, and a real abundance of arpeggios. Such features can be found all over 17th century operas, songs, and instrumental programmatic music that explicitly depicted the hunt. By the second half of the 18th century, when Haydn and Mozart were writing string quartets, the association between such musical figures and the image and character of the hunt was quite strong, as Schubart's musical description of the sounds of the event imply. When Haydn published his very first string quartet, Opus 1, No. 1, B-flat, the hunt-related subtitle attached to it was not necessary. The opening arpeggio, in a bounding triplet-y 6/8 time, communicates the idea on its own. This string quartet in B-flat was written in the late 1750s or early 1760s. It's a collection of short movements in the style of a serenade or divertimento, music that we could perhaps imagine being heard before setting out on a hunting expedition. The first two measures of the first movement of this piece, where the strings ascend an arpeggio in unison in a controlled 6/8 time, is the opening blast of a horn call. Smaller groups team up for gestures in thirds, but this stately arpeggio idea certainly dominates the texture until the very end of sections in this movement. Then, before sections come to a close, the first violin takes off, playing virtuosic runs up and down the instrument that are still arpeggiated, but are fast enough that they really don't sound brassy. Each section of this short first movement closes with quiet trill figures, a modest allusion to that other feature of hunt music, little chirping trumpet-like calls. In Haydn's Opus 1 No. 1 Quartet, only the first movement appears to be consumed with this topic of the hunt. The second minuet movement opens with allusions to the musette style, where a pulsing drone provided by cello and viola supports a simple melody in the first violin. The contrasting trio is in the key of E-flat major. Here, the two violins and the two lower string instruments are consistently set against one another. The third movement, an adagio, features a formal strategy that Haydn used in many of his early slow movements. He starts the movement with just a few introductory measures. Here, an understated, poignant contrapuntal gesture that establishes the key of E-flat major. Then he goes into an aria in a contrasting mood. The violin sings above pulsed accompaniment from the other strings. Haydn closes the movement with a repetition of that contrapuntal introduction. It's a very theatrical technique where quite different music opens and closes the curtain on the sweet song heard in the body of the movement. The fourth movement of the B-flat major quartet is another minuet. Again, the cello and viola seem to be an inseparable team, barking out interruptions to the violin's duet. The finale of Haydn's Opus 1 No. 1 Quartet is full of the violinistic virtuosity that was suppressed in the first movement. Quick triplets and string crossing figures show us that Haydn must have had some pretty good players to work with. This was certainly one of the luxuries that helped him to write boldly for string quartet throughout his life. In the 1780s, Joseph Haydn and Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart often played in string quartet together on informal occasions. Haydn on violin, together with Baron Karl Ditters von Dittersdorf, Johann Baptist von Hall on cello, and Mozart on viola. In 1785, Mozart dedicated a sequence of six quartets to Haydn. This music is clearly indebted to Haydn's contributions to the genre, but it also likely reflects some of what they learned from one another while playing together. The fourth quartet of the sequence, written in 1784, was, like the earlier Haydn quartet, in B-flat major. Its opening, also in 6/8 time, is marked by arpeggios and alternations of tonic and dominant chords that evoke that horn-like quality, and led to its eventual nicknaming as Mozart's Hunt Quartet. A little variation on the arpeggio idea that happens in the first line reminds me of those chirping trumpet gestures, an alternative way to telegraph the idea of a hunt. It's this chirping idea, which in its way is more violinistic than the arpeggios of the main theme, that becomes the most important motif of the movement. The conflict between these melodic modes, arpeggios versus little scalar noodles, is particularly clear at the start of the development section. The violin plays a new melody that we could well imagine being performed by a horn singing above an orchestra. But we quickly move to the minor key to focus on those noodles. In the end, that arpeggio idea comes to a full cadence. But those little chirps and the violinistic scalar melodies that they have evolved into get the last laugh. Again, it's only in the first movement of this quartet that the hunt topic is explicitly referred to. The second minuet movement of Mozart's B-flat quartet is warm and sweet. Those forzandos on the final beats of measures of the melody give it a slightly off-balance feeling. The adagio in this piece is, like many slow movements of Mozart's string quartets, operatic in the contrasts of character it features and in the lyrical quality that adheres to so many of the tunes. This adagio, in particular, gives quite an important role to the cello. The lowest voice in the group establishes a dialogue with the soaring voice of the violin, in some of Mozart's most effective passages for these two instruments together. In the slow movement of Haydn's B-flat quartet, we heard beautiful descending lines played by the violin above a pulsing accompaniment. In Mozart, a transitional modulatory passage in this slow movement invokes the same texture. but he lets the cello take over that descending tune. The switch gives the pulsing gesture, as played by the other three strings, a very different meaning. The first phrase of the Allegro assai finale of the Hunt Quartet is this very fun violin lick. There's a little tag to this tune, which becomes a main unit of development in the movement. Several contrasting themes occur, including what I call this off to the races melody. And a slightly more poignant closing tune. But that little tag can't be avoided. It keeps the music from getting too serious. At the very end of the piece, it is sequenced up and up, driving the music to its logical end. These 18th century hunting string quartets point to this sense of regal nobility and play, but they're of course musically alluding to a quite brutal activity. The music contained in them reflects some of the same nostalgic sense of the sonorous horn call that compels the deer to soak up the sound, or those piglets suckling in 3/8 time that was expressed in the slightly ridiculous description of Christian Schubart. It is this disconnect between noble and delightful music and a cultural pastime that glorified violence that the composer Jörg Widmann wished to satirize in his third string quartet. It's an outrageous, wild, and extremely funny piece of music written in 2003 and titled Jagdquartett, or Hunt Quartet. Using a set of musical associations, like all of these gestures affiliated with the hunt, once they've been established for a particular audience, is not all that difficult. But composing criticisms of that set of associations using only notes and rhythms is really quite a challenge. So here, Widmann boosts those efforts by transforming a string quartet performance into a theatrical one. The quartet opens with the members of the group swishing their bows through the air with menace. Widmann departs from a hunt-inspired piece that Robert Schumann wrote in 1831 to close off a set of solo piano works, his Papillon, Opus 2. Schumann's music features bounding dotted rhythms and a sequence of those special horn fifths that I mentioned earlier. Hey! It's a 6-8 gallop with accents on final beats. We hear this and we expect that this quartet is going to be a lot of fun, and we're right. This is a hilarious piece, music of irresistible rhythmic energy and an abundance of string quartet antics that keep us light and laughing throughout. It is not, however, a simple transcription of Schumann's music. Widmann quickly breaks his borrowed tune down, interrupting with brutal dissonances. He comes to eliminate those horn fifths, but he does preserve the infectious rhythmic quality for a while. We think perhaps this is just a particularly breathless hunt, with little time for harmonically resonant horn calls. Partway through the piece, the three upper strings turn their vicious attention to the cellist, whom they eventually kill. This winds up getting laughs, and Widmann fully expected that, writing in his program note, "A hunt is violent. Someone or something is killed. In my piece, it's the cellist who dies with a long scream at the end. Audiences sometimes smile at this moment, but what I wanted them to feel was that they might start laughing, but that it dies in their throats. It's ambivalent." The second half of this concert program features music of Johannes Brahms, his third and final string quartet, Opus 67, written in 1875. He dedicated the piece to his friend, the amateur cellist Theodor Wilhelm Engelmann, describing it lightly as a useless trifle that distracted him from the impending premiere of his first symphony. He warned Engelmann that there's no cello solo in it, but such a tender viola solo that you may want to change your instrument for its sake. The quartet is, like the music of Haydn and Mozart heard on this program, in B-flat major. It opens with a 6-8 movement and with an accented arpeggio gesture. It would seem that we are off to yet another hunt. But Brahms very quickly creates a rhythmic texture that destabilizes those hunting horn calls, a chromatic anti-melody that would most certainly disturb the 3-8 suckling of those piglets. Though the allusion to Mozart in this movement is clear, so too are the innovations that Brahms has brought to this genre. A transitional theme in unison arpeggios in F minor presents a more ghostly world than anything we encountered in Haydn or Mozart's hunt music. A secondary theme alternates 6-8 with a more stately 2-4 meter. and a quite exhilarating closing section of the movement's exposition puts winding scales in 2-4 on top of triplets below, a rhythmic layering that establishes a central conflict of this piece, triplety arpeggios, here provided by the second violin, and flowing duple meter scales, here begun in the first violin and then played by cello and viola. At the end of the movement, Brahms again sets these rhythms against one another, syncopations against straightforward triplets, and then those triplets against more flowing 16th notes. Two members of the group seem to want to stay in the hunting nostalgia of Brahms's 18th century models, and the others are pushing for slightly more complex Wagnerian fare. As with the music of Haydn and Mozart on this program, the hunt is primarily the occupation of the first movement of Brahms's B-flat quartet. The second movement, marked Andante, features a cantabile violin melody in F major, one of Brahms's eminently singable tunes. The movement involves some gorgeous intimate writing that makes it hard to take seriously Brahms's insistence that this piece was a mere trifle. The third agitato movement is a minuet of sorts, and home to Brahms's promised viola solo, which might inspire any of us to take up that larger fiddle. In the central trio of this movement, violins and cello establish a harmonic and rhythmic framework that the viola eventually joins with an urgent melody. Brahms's B-flat major quartet ends with one of his large and beguiling theme and variation sets. The theme is truly bizarre. It sounds at the outset like some sort of merry processional, the nobility of the town walk down the street to a tune that modulates comfortably from B-flat to D minor. The next four measures are a total departure that begin and end securely in D major. Then Brahms leaps back to the home key and finishes off without a proper cadence. When that second part is repeated, we can hardly believe that the theme itself has concluded. The first variation on this strange creation, building on what we heard in the third movement, gives a very important role to the viola. In the fourth variation, Brahms begins to take us to more adventurous places. He moves the set to B-flat minor and invites the group to indulge in slightly disarming polyrhythms. For the next variation, Brahms modulates to D-flat major, a locally comfortable move from B-flat minor, but a further step away from the general home key of B-flat. The insistent triplets in the cello serve not only to create that polyrhythmic texture we heard in the fourth variation, but to remind us of the strangely static nature of this theme. The lack of a proper cadence within the repeated theme template makes this movement feel a bit like running in place. Perhaps we turn to a different corner of the room for each variation, but we're not really going anywhere. Brahms's next installment in this collection is even more remote, a molto dolce variation in G flat major. Those pizzas, first in the cello and then in the viola, combined with the sweet syncopations from the other strings, create this otherworldliness, a sense here that we are running in place as before, but surrounded by heavenly clouds. It's a true shock, then, to be brought down to earth again in Variation 7. Without warning, Brahms returns to the key of B-flat major, and he brings back the music from the first movement. He makes those hunting gestures fit perfectly to the bizarre theme he's built this finale around. But he doesn't stop there. Brahms gives us yet another variation, this time in B-flat minor, which takes material from the first movement's transition and fits it to that theme. Here we have to wonder, Is he going to do this with all of the music from the first movement? Will we endlessly cycle through these variations and repetitions of things we've heard before, always discovering new things but never quite going anywhere? Just when we fear this is the case, he begins a developmental coda, which will bring this piece to a close. And at long, long last, he gives us a version of the end of his strange theme that actually comes to a real cadence. Many of Brahms's later chamber works display an interest in cyclic forms, and this return to the Hunt ideas of the first movement seems to be an early experiment in such practices. But there is also a degree to which Brahms is taking advantage of the clarity that association with a particular topic can lend to a gesture like his arpeggiated B-flat 6-8 hunting tune. His particular themes evoke that specific name or label, and then having that label available in turn enhances the reusability of those themes, so that when the Hunt returns at the very end of Brahms's quartet, we're hearing a culmination and musical development not only of his own first movement ideas, but of a broader set of elements of musical style, this musical concept that has been discussed and commented on at great length over the course of this whole concert. What Brahms actually has to say about the Hunt as a musical or cultural phenomenon is a little bit more ambiguous than what Widmann, for example, presents in his piece, but it is perhaps no less complex or critical as a musical statement. Thank you for listening. Audio notes are written and produced by Nikki Sweat, in consultation with David Finkel and Wu Han. To learn more about the Hunt as it crops up in concert music, I would recommend reading Raymond Monel's 2006 book, The Musical Topic, Hunt, Military, and Pastoral, Musical Meaning and Interpretation, published by Indiana University Press. To learn more about topics in music in general, check out the Oxford Handbook of Topic Theory in Music, published in 2014 by Oxford University Press. Audio excerpts are courtesy of the following artists and organizations: Haydn's Quartet in B-flat Major, Opus 1, No. 1, and Jörg Widmann's String Quartet No. 3, Jagd Quartet, were played by the Danish String Quartet. Mozart's String Quartet in B-flat Major, K458, was played by the Emerson String Quartet and can be heard on the Deutsche Grammophon album Mozart String Quartets. Brahms's String Quartet in B-flat Major, Opus 67, was also played by the Emerson String Quartet and can be heard on the album Johannes Brahms, the String Quartets and Piano Quintet. Audio notes are a copyrighted production of Music at Menlo.